Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Behind the welcoming face of the web is a huge world of and marketplace for data, personal data, about you and everyone else. That's made the web experience increasingly personal. It's also radically remade presumptions of privacy, radically diminished them. There's a new round of debate over what to do about that, and new services that let you try to buy your privacy, your good name, back to pay for your own privacy. This hour on Point, the new age and price of privacy. We will hear in this hour from web thinker Esther Dyson, from a computer science crusader for privacy, and from the CEO of a company offering to help manage your privacy online. But first, joining me from New York is Nick Bolton, technology reporter and blogger for the New York Times. He's been writing about online privacy and the lack thereof. Nick Bolton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Nick, there's so much going on here, but the thing that caught our eye right off was this notion that there was a time when you just kind of presumed you had privacy, unless somebody was, you know, peeking through the windows or going through your mail, which was a federal offense. But now the presumption is turned the other way, and people appear to be prepared to pay to buy their own privacy. What's on offer out there, Nick, if you're worried about your exposure online?
Well, there's a whole new range of companies that are starting to crop up, and they really started a few years ago, but now a lot of people are starting to use them, and they're called reputation online management companies. One of them that I recently profiled in the Times was reputation.com, which you can go to and ask them to manage your privacy. You can ask them to try to remove things from the web that you don't want people to see, and to really kind of help you fix things that are online.
Now, one thing is PR. I mean, if you've got something online that's true and you're just not happy about it, I don't know, something in the news, you name it, associated with you. There's another level, which is all the personal data that's getting scooped up and moved around. Nick Bolton, is Reputation.com just a personal PR agency, or is it really, are it and others looking at ways for you to control the whole flow of data that's around us and being scraped off us all the time?
Well, what's really fascinating is, I think, you know, in the past it was celebrities and lawyers and bankers that really had to worry about what they put online and what they managed, and they actually did employ PR companies to actually fix the problems that they had, whether it was something that appeared on page six for a celebrity or it was a negative comment that somebody wrote about a doctor or a lawyer. But now that's happening with everyone, and I think what's happened is we have these devices that we all carry around with us that take photos, and we can send tweets and status updates, and even if you haven't done anything wrong, somebody could post something about you online that is negative. And I think what's happened now is that we have to finally really look at what we're putting online, what other people are putting online, and how we can manage it. And it really is taking these companies to help us do it.
And then there's the information that just travels with us and is eagerly harvested when we visit all kinds of sites. I mean, people looking into online activities, your political views, your health worries, your shopping habits, your financial situation, sometimes without your name and sometimes even with your name. And I guess there are also companies trying to help you, sort of build a better shield around your privacy as you go online, Nick.
Yeah, so what's happening now is, I think we're kind of reaching this point where people are realizing how much information is out there about them online. And, you know, advertising companies, social networks like Facebook, search engines like Google, they really know more about us than we actually probably know about ourselves. And they've been tracking us for quite a while. And and we're seeing some legislation that the White House is really pushing forward. John Kerry and John McCain are pushing forward also, which is what we call the Privacy Bill of Rights. And there's this idea that we'll be able to actually give consumers the option to opt out. The same way you can opt out of phone calls from marketers, you'll be able to opt out of advertising online that's tracking you and seeing what you're looking at and what you're purchasing. And this is actually something that's being discussed actively right now by the government.
Is that supported? I mean, the ad advertising industry has become hugely depended on all that information. $26 billion U.S. online advertising industry alone, I'm reading here. Are they fighting the idea of a privacy bill of rights or supporting
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're saying that the privacy industry is lobbying, that they're saying that they can't do their jobs properly and they can't deliver a great experience for consumers with this new bill of rights. But I think that in reality, there's probably a balance in the middle. One of the problems that exists right now is that it's impossible to delete information from the web. And it's also impossible to find out what these companies know about you. You know, you can't go to Facebook and say, hey, what do you know about me? Because they're not going to tell you. And I think that what we really need is an option for people to say, hey, you know what? That's fine if you want to track me and deliver ads that are relevant to me, or I don't want to be tracked and I want to be able to turn that off from the web.
Nick, talk about the envelope of information that can travel around with us as we're on the web. I think a lot of people have a pretty acute sense of it, but may not know exactly what all is out there at this point. I mean, what's the range of information that can accumulate around us as we move through the web and get scraped off and sold? How's that work, and how much is it?
Well, it's quite fascinating. You could look at a pretty active internet user that's using social networks and location-based services, and for them, there is a tremendous amount of information, especially around the locations that they travel and the things that they purchase and the places they eat. But even a novice internet user that just checks their email online and does a few web searches, these companies know a tremendous amount about them too, and they don't realize this. You know, a lot of companies don't realize that when you type a search into Google, that it remembers that so it can deliver an ad next to whatever it is you're searching for. They also don't realize that when you're using Gmail or another mail service, that these companies are looking through your mail to find ads that are words that are relevant that they can deliver advertising accordingly. So it's pretty vast, what's happening on there. Also, if you go to Netflix, Netflix monitors what videos you watch so they can deliver better videos. If you go to Amazon, it's the same with books. The breadth of this just really travels far and wide.
I'm looking here at a news story just from yesterday saying a grand jury has sought information from Pandora, the music service, looking into a part of a federal investigation to smartphone privacy that can tell, of course, then it's not only what music you're listening to, but on your smartphone, Pandora, maybe others, they know exactly where you are, your unique ID numbers, even your user's name. I mean, they're physically tracking you through life, or they could.
Yeah, it's one of the things that that's happened recently with a lot of these smartphones and mobile applications. You know, if you install Pandora on your iPhone, it says, hey, is it okay for us to use your location? And you of course, will probably say yes because you don't realize what is happening. But in reality, what they were doing is they were really tracking where you were when you were listening to that music. And there's really no reason for them to do that.
Reason in that they sell it to advertisers and make money off that, right?
It's a reason for them. It's not a reason for consumers. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of applications that are doing this, and it's not really fair to consumers to not have the option to say, hey, I want to remove this data from the web. I don't want you to be able to track me on my mobile phone, and I don't want to see advertising that's based on the location that I'm in at this present time.
Nick, what do you see coming here? Individual users sort of on their own to figure out, maybe even buy protection of their privacy as they work on the web? You can hardly avoid it these days. Or some kind of government intervention, privacy bill of rights that will offer legal protection, or do we have to buy it one by one?
I think it's going to be a collection of all of the things you just mentioned. I think that a lot of people just don't have the ability to actually erase things from the web or even to understand and control what's happening. I recently wrote a story about Facebook's privacy policies and how there used to be 50 settings to change your privacy policy settings online, and it's impossible for most people to understand that. It takes hours to go through these things, and that's just one service. And I think that the government really needs to get involved and give people the option to not only erase things online, but also to control things as they move forward, as they surf the web.
Nick Bilton with the New York Times. Thanks for your reporting, Nick, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Bilton, author of I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works, joining us there from New York. With us right now from Palm Beach, Florida, Esther Dyson, huge figure in thinking about the web from its early days and right up until today. She's an angel investor in internet startups, former chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, head of EdVenture, regular commentator on emerging digital technology, author of Release 2.1. Esther Dyson, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Have we peaked yet when it comes to sort of scooping into people's privacy or not?
I want to the reason you have more than one person on the show is obviously so they can say different things. I want to go back further, and privacy is actually a rather modern concept. In the old days, you were either rich and you lived surrounded by servants and you didn't even go to the bathroom alone because someone was there to take the chamber pot out for you. Someone else dressed you and so forth. If you were poor, you lived in a house probably with a few goats as well as a whole bunch of family members. And everybody in the village knew what you were up to. So we're, and I'm not saying we should go back to that, but what I am saying is that concepts of privacy and what's appropriate for other people to know and the technology by which they know it have changed dramatically.
But, you know, I mean, even democracy is a pretty relatively new concept, right? A couple of hundred years,
yes.
But people aren't planning on turning back on that. Privacy may be real.
And I'm just trying to make people make, just put in a little perspective that things change. And how are things changing now? One way things are changing is it's becoming extremely complex. And as Nick rightly said, it's very hard to understand what the hell is going on, what's being tracked, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think we're going to find a ground in the middle. I think what needs to happen is that individuals can choose where on the ground they want to stand. And they will be much better equipped to decide that for themselves because they will understand the issues better. And what the government needs to do is not mandate one set of privacy rules for everybody because people have different preferences. Some people like to post where they are. They like to be known. They like to, and others don't. And yes, if you change your mind and you want to become more private, that is a problem. But it's also a problem in life if you change your mind about your past. So we need much better understanding, and I'll go into it later, of how to do this.
Been joined in this hour by Esther Dyson, a big thinker on the web from early days of the web, a former chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's head of EdVenture, author of Release 2.1. She's also a board member of the marketing company WPP and the Sunlight Foundation, joining us today from Palm Beach, Florida. With me now in the studio now is LaTanya Sweeney. She's currently a visiting fellow, a professor at Harvard University's Center for Research on Computation and Society. She's a distinguished professor of computer science, technology, and policy at Carnegie Mellon University. She's a self-titled computer policy scientist. LaTanya Sweeney, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So here we are. Esther Dyson's describing this kind of changing ebb and flow, I guess mainly ebb, of privacy over time. Reminds us that there was a time when, I don't know if you want to go back far enough, you know, we lived in caves and there we were with one another. We got used to something different in the 20th century. Now that is rapidly falling away. Where do you see us in the arc of privacy and the lack there and lack thereof on the web? Is the bottom still falling out of privacy? Are we still redefining it toward much more openness, or do you see resistance setting in that's going to change that?
Well, I think that is the challenge of this decade, is who's going to control the data. There's a lot of money in the data. Historical privacy protections are proving themselves to be outdated. And many of us are looking for new directions forward, not a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. But one of the things that some of us have been thinking about is a concept called a privacy marketplace, the idea that individuals could be in control of their data. They could assemble it, control it.
And if you want it, buy it from me or something like that.
That's right. And the purpose of the purchasing is really to compensate for harms. So the truth is, the more I engage in data sharing, the more risk I have for long-term harms, and it's difficult for me to always predict those harms. And the economics of privacy research tells us that even if people are made aware of long-term harms, they tend to discount them. So the idea of having a marketplace that will compensate on the front end for risk or insulate people from harms seems one way forward.
Harms like what?
Well, there are all kinds of harms. You could have the loss of income, loss of life insurance, your credit worthiness.
Loss of income would be because
related
to privacy?
Yeah. So, for example, there are a lot of databases like 23andMe and so forth where people provide their genetic information. And one of the consequences of that is you don't actually know what science will learn tomorrow.
So and you could look like genetically damaged goods at some point to an employer.
Exactly. Now, in general, they're not supposed to discriminate, but then you have the burden of trying to prove that you didn't get that job or you didn't get that promotion based on discrimination. And Lanois at the University of Illinois has already shown us that he did a survey of Fortune 500 companies, and something like 37% admitted to making hiring, firing, and promotional decisions based on medical information.
Esther Dyson, what about it? I mean, I guess my first question for you, given your opening observation, Esther, is whether we might end up with a new universal standard of privacy expectations going to be different for everyone. What about a marketplace to decide?
I agree that a marketplace makes a whole lot of sense, but I wouldn't say you're necessarily being compensated for future harms. It's your data. You should decide how much you value it and what you want to sell it for. And that's really what a marketplace is, not some third party saying these harms you need to be compensated for.
Well, but you're being paid for something.
Yes, you're being paid for data that you're being paid for giving data to somebody who wants it, and ideally with a contract that determines how that person you sell the data to can use it. There are lots of things that happen by contract, and it's your data. You have the ability to give it or not, unless you're coerced to give it in some cases by the government. And therefore, you should be able to set a price on it. The problem is, up until now, there haven't been very many good tools to do that, number one. And number two, as Nick pointed out originally, it's extremely complicated. What's changing is people are beginning to understand all these issues better, especially the kids on Facebook. And just as, you know, 100 years ago, people would have said income tax and payroll tax and Medicare. This is all so confusing. How can we manage it? It's amazing what people can do when they're better informed and care. The problem right now is you go online, you don't know what's going on. And there are a lot of companies making these promises, we won't
do this or that.
Well, we won't show you ads, but the problem isn't showing me the ads. The problem is tracking me. Showing me the ads is simply a sign that you know about me. But what people object to often is, I don't want them to know this stuff.
But Esther,
and I can't go online and find out what they know. If they can sell it to third parties, why can't they show it to me?
And of course, they do sell it to third parties. It's been, I mean, most people's impression, I think, is it's been kind of a Wild West on privacy out there. If we were to move something that had some more structure to it, even a marketplace around it, how would that happen, Esther? I mean, why would these advertising and, you know, data sale companies willingly march into that corral when they've had the freedom to sort of just ride all over the place?
There's a wonderful poem by Hilaire Belloc. It says, hold tightly to the hand of nurse for fear of finding something worse. And the thing that's worse is this legislation. And so they're, you know, it's beginning, and it's beginning badly. As you mentioned, I'm on the board of not just WPP Group, but also 23andMe. And I think the industry as a whole has done a really terrible job of not, this is the advertising industry, I'd say the medical industry, or at least 23andMe is being pretty good. But people don't understand what's going on, and the advertising industry has just said, don't worry about it, it's good for you. And that's finally beginning to change. And so companies will discover that the only way they can get the information is by paying for it, and that if they don't start doing that, yes, there will be legislation and their hands will be tied. And the market will be messy. Most markets are. They're, you know, people with different opinions and desires, different kinds of companies. But we also need, as individuals, to get realistic. If you do something really stupid and it's in the press, you know, sorry. And so to some extent, yes, everybody's becoming a much more public person. I can stop Facebook from selling my data, but if I share a stupid photo with my friend, I'm going to have a tough time stopping my friend from sharing my data, unless it's a good friend. But this is the problem. You do things, stupid things with people you trusted, and then they turn out not to be trustworthy.
On the other hand, it's not just about doing stupid things. I mean, the thing you do maybe to have a medical test of some kind, and a lot of people, I think, would like the presumption that that's their information.
And it is, according to a lot of laws. I mean, the medical industry is already very effectively regulated. That doesn't mean that there aren't mistakes, that nothing's perfect. But companies like 23andMe are very careful with your data, and we don't hand it out to employers. If you really are nervous, you can sign up with a fake name. We don't care. We don't know who you are. Medical data is a very, very different area, and you're right. It's much more sensitive and already much better protected.
But just one of many. Esther Dyson, LaTanya Sweeney, please stand by. We have so many listeners who want in on this conversation. Let me go first, if I may, to
find out who they are.
Yeah, let's find out. Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. That's all we know, but Anne, it's good to have you.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just want to bring up a totally different angle. I used to work for a life insurance company as a computer programmer. They hire overseas programmers from India, and they give them access to the customer live data to do their programming and testing of their programming. This is an industry-wide standard, and I imagine most banks as well.
And when you say customer live data, do you mean data that the customer has voluntarily given to the insurance company or some wider realm of data?
Absolutely. Everything the insurance company needs to know about that person. Plus, if the customer is actually paying for their policies through their bank, the bank information for transferring that money over to the bank, I don't think the American public knows about this. It's deep under the covers.
And forgive me, but I still don't understand. Are you talking about information that I give directly, voluntarily to my insurance company, or that they gather off the web whether I know it or not?
No. What you filled out on your application when you went to buy your life insurance policy.
Well, what's surprising about that? If I put it on the application, of course, they're going to know it. Is there a problem with that?
Well, when it gets into the computer system and onto the database, and then the insurance company hires programmers from India and gives them access to that data for testing, programming changes. What I'm saying is, these people, we have no way of knowing, we have no way of background checking. They're employees just like employees in the United States.
So they may be leaking it or sharing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have no control over the background checking of these programmers. They come and go for a few months, they might work, and then they go on to another company. But we are giving them a silver platter of our live customer data, and I'm talking about big insurance companies. I imagine the banking industry is in on this as well.
And we've got it. I mean, at least I must say it sounds like a bug, not a feature, but I don't know how widespread abuse of that might be. Let me get one more, if I may. Mary Ellen in Manning, South Carolina. Mary Ellen, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I had a private telephone conversation Friday morning with my accountant, and I learned for the first time my husband's business income. Sunday evening, I just decided to search the web to see how often my husband's business website comes up. And lo and behold, not only a company out of Ohio who's disreputable has a website where they not only had his company name, but our home address and the precise amount of money that I had been just learned about Friday morning.
So are you?
I didn't even know it till Friday.
But you're not suggesting they got it somehow off your telephone conversation with your accountant?
I'm not. But what I am saying is that it was frightening, and that you feel violated. You don't know how it occurred. I called the accountant, and they're completely puzzled. And nobody else learned about it. We certainly haven't filed our taxes yet. And they had it out there, not only our home address, but the exact amount of money he made, and for anybody to look at. I mean, friends, customers, competitors.
Yeah.
It was total violation.
Welcome to that world, Mary Ellen. I'm sorry it came as kind of a shock. LaTanya Sweeney, I mean, there are a lot of sites now that aggregate all kinds of information, sort of one-stop shopping. You can, as Mary Ellen found out, you can see income, you can see address, you can see a photo of their home, and on and on, right down to what they owe, what they don't, bankruptcy, you name it. A lot of this information was traditionally out there, but now it's so much more accessible. You don't have to go to 16 different offices to put it together. It's on a silver platter.
Right, exactly. And this goes back to sort of historical privacy protections being inadequate in today's data-rich network society. and the need to look further. What you heard from the both of the callers is sort of the shock factor about the information that's out there. And even in the first caller, where an individual may have given the data, her point was, who would know that this other data went to some other place in a different country for mm-hmm. which HIPAA, for example, doesn't even apply?
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what harms could come to an individual? The individual may know they're harmed, but have no way of tracking back to know that's the cause of that harm.
Yes, but LaTanya, please understand, I don't know this company that the caller was talking about, mm-hmm. and they may be a horrible company, but if they're a regular company, they have a contract with the company that provides the programming services. That company doesn't want to have its own reputation messed up and lose business. So, you know, again, things aren't ironclad, but I think it's you know, just because people in India doesn't mean they're all crooks.
Well, I don't want to make the conversation about outsourcing.
Right.
And there have been instances where medical records have shown up on the internet and so forth in an attempt to harass the company in the United States to pay them. So there have been reported incidences. But it's not really about outsourcing. It's mm-hmm. about the availability and the sharing of data that's not transparent to individuals and how data is put together. You know, even PricewaterhouseCoopers predicts that the sharing of medical information outside of the patient's care is going to be a $2 billion market. IM Else Health takes prescription data without individuals' knowledge,
mm-hmm.
compiles it together, and then sells it for marketing information back to pharmaceutical companies. Axiom goes around and collects information from public record sites. Geisinger, which is a large medical information system, actually set up a company called Med Mining that sells its medical data.
Med Mining, as in data mining.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point being, not to point that these are somehow bad players or that they're doing anything wrong, the issue is the lack of transparency and the way that information can be combined, given to someone else to whom I'm interacting, who could make decisions about me for which I'm not a party to.
Esther Dyson says it's not about harm. It's kind of about a personal decision about how open you want to be.
Yeah, I mean, and there may be harms. I'm not, but I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not that the individual is the one who decides whether they want to sell their data or not. And I totally agree with LaTanya that the system is way too obscure and opaque and people don't understand what's going on. And that's where I would like, you know, more government regulation to require disclosure, but then allow people to make up their own minds.
LaTanya.
So we agree about the disclosure aspect. And that's why I like very much these concepts around privacy marketplaces, because they allow individuals to make nuanced decisions. But it can't be a free market, because people are disadvantaged in a free market. And so the idea of the privacy marketplace is that the market design has to provide a floor, like a minimum compensation that you should receive based on the economic harms that you could endure from the risk of sharing your data, or the market design has to insulate you from the harm.
But will you have to legislate companies into that arena? I mean,
no,
Google CEO Eric Schmidt famously in 2009 said, you know, if you have something you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. That hardly sounds like an attitude of voluntarily, you know, going into your marketplace.
So the stimulus bill the bill of 2009 in the space in medical care in particular, I think sets a great model. It sets a model that says individuals can get a copy of their medical information. They can assemble their own information. They can control that information and they can sell it. It doesn't prohibit the other sharing of data that goes places. It doesn't upset anyone else's revenue streams related to those other data sets or data sharing. But by taking advantage of the fact that the individual could be the center of the data, you can actually provide incredibly comprehensive data sources. You can imagine adding to it my telecommunications data, my purchasing data, and so forth, and then making that available.
LaTanya Sweeney, please stand by, and Esther Dyson with us from Palm Beach, Florida. It's great to have you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Lots of response online here. It's interesting. Esther, LaTanya, we've got Charlie saying on the website, anonymity on the internet seems so 90s. Privacy is looking pretty old-fashioned, too. A lot of people have that attitude these days. But here's another. Adam says, I'm so paranoid about Facebook selling my personal information to others that I've removed all of my personal information except for my full name And Christina says the presumption of privacy is only a thing of the past because we the people have allowed businesses to slowly erode it away. If I may, let me turn to California right now and Michael Furtick. He's CEO of Reputation.com. Michael Furtick, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So what does your company do?
We protect privacy and reputation on the Internet. So we put some of the toothpaste back in the tube by removing your information from databases you don't want to be in. And we also prevent some of the toothpaste from getting out of the tube in the first place by making sure that advertising networks can't collect information about you and by giving you cloaking and encryption devices to make sure that social networks like Facebook actually can't see some of the content you post there. So it's a pretty cool set of tools. By the way, many of them are free, since it's not just a paid set of services.
Okay. Now, to me, anyway, privacy and reputation seem like two pretty distinct things. If there's something about me on the web that you don't like, I can pay you to come in and kind of bury it so it shows up deeper on the search engines, right? It doesn't pop up right away. That's one thing. What do you do on the privacy front about, I don't know, my personal data as I travel around the web? What can you offer there?
So some of the websites that I think have come to your attention and that are often complained of on the Internet, like Spokio and so forth, are ones that we can just zap your information from. And we zap them from a lot of these websites, and we do it all at once. And a lot of the sites make it actually pretty cumbersome and difficult to remove yourself from them. And they have a lot of the very deeply personal information, including income information, health information, other kinds of registered personal information on them. And they sell them to anyone they want to sell them to, and they publish them to the world. And they make it kind of tricky to get yourself out of them. And also, they repopulate with some frequency. So we have taken it upon ourselves to aggregate the removal process from many of these sites, and also then by breaking some of the links in the chain of information communication, actually prevent you from getting into some of these sites in the first place, or prevent certain kinds of information from getting into those sites. So privacy and reputation are different doors into the same conversation. Our customers don't really think about privacy or reputation. They think about their digital stuff, right? And some of it's kind of, hey, someone's saying something about me that I don't like, or some of it's, I don't like that this fact is out there. So take your income level, for example.
Okay.
Or whether you have some kind of health issue.
Mm-hmm.
Both subjects, your income and your health issue, are matters of privacy, but they're also matters that affect your reputation. And so, you know, our customers don't actually make the distinction that our name brand actually does. Our customers don't really feel a need to reconcile the difference between reputation and privacy. They just think of it as my stuff.
We're talking about potentially a marketplace here for what people think of as private information. Getting consumers in on that marketplace would be one way to go. But you've written recently, I mean, what everybody essentially knows, there's already a big marketplace with this information. Who's in on the existing marketplace?
So the basic problem is the accidental architecture of the Internet. It's an accident that if you look at the $1 trillion of wealth that's been created on the web so far, setting aside hardware companies and ISPs, 90% of what's left is an advertising business, which means that the main playbook that Silicon Valley knows how to run is create a product, get people to use it free, collect the data about them, and then sell it. And by the way, like your other guests, I've been listening to much of the show.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with actual informed consent that is an actual informed trade of being able to use something free in exchange for selling my data, right? But we have a scenario in which there's a very mature ecosystem of data collection, data aggregation, then data alienation and sale without actual and informed consent, right? You don't actually know how the data are being collected, what data are being collected, and how they're being used. I think we can imagine a different world in which, I've published on the topic of a data privacy vault, okay?
Okay.
Something that my company's building. So imagine if you could go to Netflix or Amazon and rent the movie, and Netflix never knows who you actually are. All they find out is that you exist, you have a valid form of payment that they do not know, that you are creditworthy, that you're going to be on the hook if you steal the movie, right? And you have an address that exists and is valid, right? Imagine a world in which there's an actual layer of anonymity between you and that transaction. It's an accident of the Internet's evolution that has not happened. There have been attempts at this. So PayPal or Google Checkout do that kind of thing around payments, but they don't do it around your identity. And it's entirely doable, by the way. It just requires a lot of innovation.
Michael Furtick, hold the thought for just a moment. Esther Dyson, How about that? Should I have to pay a vault to keep that level of privacy? Is that the new sort of contract that's required? Or, you know, what about legislation that says you're entitled to be that private, whether you're paying for it or not, Esther?
Well, no, I think it's like anything else. You don't need to buy the movie in the first place. If you want to buy the movie, you pay for the movie. If you want to buy the movie anonymously, you may pay a little more because you need a third party to guarantee that you're creditworthy and to keep your credit and payment data separate from what the vendor of the movie sees. I don't think that's morally offensive. I'm sorry. I think it makes total sense.
LaTanya, you're talking about a marketplace where the consumer would get paid, but here, once again, they're paying out for that privacy. Is that just make sense in the new world we're in or not?
Well, I like the vault idea because in some sense it gets to the idea of insulating the individual from harm. Because in some sense, if you don't know who I am and I can do these transactions anonymously, then I'm in good shape. But there's still lots of bandwidth and lots of transactions of data that are outside of the scope for what she's talking about. And what I like very much about the marketplace is it could be the centralized way, because if the individual is in charge of their data, they'll have more comprehensive data, mm-hmm. and that data will be even more valuable. And so in this way, I think it can be a much more efficient arrangement of data sharing as well. The purpose of not paying for privacy versus not paying for privacy. Privacy over the last few years has become increasingly the domain of those who can afford it, from the use of loyalty cards to mm-hmm. if I don't want my data in a medical record bank, I have to pay out of pocket and so forth. And so there's already been this movement towards I have to pay for privacy. But my issue about payment is, but what about the harms of the other individuals who can't afford to pay for that extra layer of protection, but who still bear the harm? And I mean harms in terms of economic loss. And so I'm looking for compensation or some kind of insulation mm-hmm. against those kinds of harms.
Michael Furtick, can you see a world that would work here where instead of building walls, we build a marketplace? I'm in it. I'm deciding every day or every week what's on offer in terms of information about me.
I think actually we're saying the same thing.
Yes.
And I think that the Privacy Vault is a device to get to that marketplace at which you have a user-centric sort of point of view. So I don't think that we have to see the world as paying for privacy. I think you can also see the world as being paid for diminishment of that privacy. So you start with this presumption of privacy by reposing all of your data in one place, perhaps quite free, you know, without cost to you. And then you get compensation depending on the value of the data for the right of some third party to get access to those data. So it just turns the existing universe on its head. But the universe as it exists, again, I want to emphasize, the most mm-hmm. important thing here to observe is that the universe that exists, the status quo, is an accident. There's no reason that the main achievement of Silicon Valley needs to have been the replacement of Sony and NBC as advertising behemoths. Like, that's not a very remarkable achievement, right, from a commercial point of view. It just happened to go down that way. And as a result, if you're an entrepreneur with an idea that for an advertising medium, then you have a whole number of investors who want to back you.
Right.
There are a whole number of people who want to buy the data. There are a whole number of people who are in business now to mash up and use the data in new and interesting ways. And by the way, on the face of it, I have no objection to that concept. There are new and interesting ways to use new and interesting amounts of data. What I don't like is the absence of the actual informed consent. So right now, look, I went to Harvard Law School. I can't read and keep up with the privacy policies of any of the companies I deal with
on
the internet.
No kidding. It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming. Right? You know, every time you get, just think of your credit card company, right? Every time they give you an update on their policy, they send you a 50-page booklet. Who can read that, right?
Good luck.
Can I just make one point here?
Yes, Esther.
The irony is, of course, if you're really concerned about your privacy, you shouldn't be putting all your data into a single centralized repository because that is dangerous. If you really want your privacy, be obscure. Use several services. Buy your videos for cash. Make up a couple of fake names. It requires effort to maintain your privacy.
But should it be so hard?
I don't think it should.
No, it shouldn't be so hard. But life is difficult. You know,
well,
it
doesn't have to be.
Free food, too? I mean,
Is asking for a little privacy the same as asking for a free lunch? I mean, we never used to look at it that way.
Well, there
have a lot of privacy.
Esther's sort of objection, which I think is you know, intellectually correct. So you don't have to have a vault that actually is a single sign-on with one password. So I mean, she's making a very technical and important point. You can have a distributed cloud-based system in which
I heard somebody use the word centralized.
And you can get past it with multiple passwords and logins.
Okay. So maybe there'll be a whole lot of silos here, not one passkey that would let everybody in. We've got a lot of listeners. Let me turn to some John in Arlington, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My comment's less on personalization and more on online reputation. And in particular with online reputation, I just want to flag the point that unlike, 10 years ago, the Internet is very much a permanent record in that, I could hire reputation.com for, $5,000 or $10,000 a year. And what they effectively do is stuff the ballot box. And they might push my negative results down a little bit, but they're never gone. And this is really complicated by the fact that journalism has evolved to have this notion of syndication. So you have reputable sources like Reuters, but then the blogosphere takes over.
And off it goes, yeah.
I've been victim of this. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make that point that it is a very permanent record, and there really isn't much you can do to erase it. You can just push the results down.
Let us hang on to that one. Jeff in Boston. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to, underscore some of the comments that have already been made, that information is indeed power, which has now been monetized. I don't think the business world really has any incentive to let that go. I think the service industry's marketing privacy, I don't believe that they can actually perform that service. They can't provide that in reality. I think more, they're marketing the illusion of privacy to make people just feel better. Color me cynical, but I think it's akin to the illusion of safety you get from Homeland Security, patting down my mom makes the world safer, which I don't really see that.
You know, those are good points, Jeff, and let me hold those two. And one more here, Stephen in Norfolk, Virginia. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that the founders of our Constitution, the framers of our Constitution, the founders of our nation recognize that institutions tend towards concentration and power of abuse, and so we have protections in our Constitution from search and seizure and from government intrusion. But I don't think they ever could have foreseen the extent to which corporations would have control over our day-to-day lives with hiring and firing and credit history and all of that. And I think there is a very real need for legislation and government protection. And it's unrealistic to say that if you don't like your information being out there, just avoid all these services, because if you have no credit rating history, you can't get a job in some places, you can't buy a home. There's a lot of things you just cannot do if you don't have a credit history.
Yeah. Well said, Stephen. Our time is short. LaTanya, first to you. Is any kind of control going to happen without government intervention here? Is there a marketplace that could emerge that would really be effective? You heard the skepticism there on people being able to deliver this. Does it take a government guarantee, somehow a legal guarantee, to make something change in this?
It's already happened. The stimulus bill in healthcare has already given individuals the right to assemble their data. I think you're definitely going to see that.
Just medical or more than that?
The medical data.
Well,
you're definitely
going
to see
more.
That over the next couple of years. The World Economic Forum has opened up the door to other types of data joining in example. There's a lot of online repositories of data that are already emerging. So it's not a matter of will it happen. It will happen. It doesn't require any government intervention to happen. And the question will be, they won't be things like informed consent. These are contracts. These are much stronger protections than the notions of consent. And to the extent that they're privacy marketplaces and not just data marketplaces, they'll also make you some guarantees about what you can, protections of harm.
Michael Furtick, to our caller who doesn't believe you or anybody else can deliver privacy. It's just the illusion that will be sold here. You can't deliver the real thing.
Well, there are three very good comments from your listeners, and I think that was the common theme among them was astute but a kind of a learned helplessness, that they're kind of throwing up their hands, and a lot of us are saying, look, we just have to give up. And I think Esther's general point of view on this, I'd like to echo, this is a constant fight, right? This is a David against Goliath moment when an entire $1 trillion advertising business is fully stacked against the consumer and the individual. And I started a company expressly because I saw the imperative need to change this. I do believe there's some need for legislative and regulatory change, but we know that unless there is a counterbalance of commercial power that actually is pro-consumer on the privacy side and on the reputation side, then the change will not be sustaining and sustainable. So I encourage your listeners to try our stuff free. I think they'll actually be quite impressed. But I understand the learned helplessness because this is a David against Goliath moment.
Esther Dyson, our time is short here, but last word goes to you. I kind of hear you saying lighten up here today. Others are saying crack down. I don't know which way you're leaning, Esther.
Well, that's kind of true, because what I'm really saying is lighten up, guys, and relax. You have the power if you only care to use it. As LaTanya says, you own the data, you can sell it. You can use Michael Furtick's services, or you can just not do a whole lot of stuff online. It's your choice.
Huh. Well, that's something for us all to reflect on. You have the power. I don't know. I'm still looking for that entire lever, Esther. I may be a little bit more in Michael Furtick's learned helplessness camp, a posture nobody really enjoys. So, okay, maybe we'll unlearn. Esther Dyson, author of Release 2.1, thank you so much for being with us today. Michael Furtick, CEO of Reputation.com, thank you, Michael, for your time.
Thank you.
And LaTanya Sweeney with me right here. Thanks for coming in, LaTanya.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.